You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 31st of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello from Studio One here in London and welcome to Midori House. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, from the situation in Ukraine to the future of the European Union, we'll review the day's top stories with Matthew Jameson and Brett Mason. Then we'll hear some of the funniest, wittiest and angriest book reviews competing to win this year's Hatchet Job of the Year award. Expect to hear something like this.
No amount of straining for high-flown uplift can disguise the fact that the goldfinch is a turkey.
We'll also be discussing films.
For me, the movies are like a machine that generates empathy. It lets you understand a little bit more about different hopes, aspirations, dreams, and fears. It helps us to identify with the people who are sharing this journey with us.
We'll review the best bits of the recent Sundance Film Festival with Stacey Wilson, senior editor at The Hollywood Reporter. All that and more, yes, more, on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A very busy show in prospect then, plenty to enjoy in the next hour on the programme. Before we get started though, let's get the latest world news. Here's David Spencer.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. The Syrian peace talks have concluded in Switzerland, with plans to hold a second round of meetings next month. After a week of talks in Geneva, the Syrian foreign minister said there had been no tangible results because of the immaturity of the opposition delegation. Walid al-Mualem also criticised what he called blatant US interference. Meanwhile, the UN World Food Programme has urged the Syrian government and opposition authorities to allow aid supplies to reach civilians. Spokesperson Elizabeth Burrs.
WFP, the World Food Programme, appeals to all parties to the conflict to grant unimpeded access to all civilians throughout the country. World Food Programme needs continuous and sustainable access to affected people to provide life-saving food assistance and to monitor and assess ongoing needs.
US Secretary of State John Kerry is set to meet opposition leaders from Ukraine on the sidelines of a security conference in Munich. He said the message from Barack Obama will be that the opposition has America's full support. He's also called on Russia to keep its distance.
We also would say to our friends in Russia, this does not have to be a zero-sum game. This is not something where Ukraine should become a proxy and trapped in some kind of larger ambition for Russia or the United States. That's not what this is about. This is about the freedom of choice for the people of Ukraine.
This week, Ukraine's President Viktor Yanukovych has signed into law an amnesty for demonstrators detained during mass unrest, and he's also repealed anti-protest legislation. The move, though, isn't likely to be enough to end the demonstrations. It's been announced that six world powers and Iran will begin talks in Vienna on February the 18th on a long-term deal for Tehran to curb parts of its nuclear program. Iran's agreed to the talks in exchange for a gradual end to some of the sanctions in place against it. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton confirmed the talks after meeting the Iranian Foreign Minister at the Munich Security Conference. Australia's Great Barrier Reef watchdog has given the go-ahead for millions of cubic metres of dredged mud to be dumped near the fragile reef. It clears the way for a major expansion of Abbot Point, which would become the world's biggest coal port. Environmentalists had fought the plan as they fear it will harm delicate corals and seagrasses. Bad weather is continuing to cause widespread disruption across parts of Europe. Strong winds and heavy snow in Serbia has closed border crossings with Croatia, Romania and Hungary to freight traffic. Authorities have warned people in the north of the country not to travel unless it's absolutely necessary. In Italy, the river Arno has burst its banks, causing flooding around the Tuscan towns of Pisa and Florence. More than 1,000 people have been caught up in the flooding and all emergency services in the area are on high alert. Heavy snow in northern Italy has led to blackouts and closed schools. In the UK, some areas are again on flood alert after the wettest January on record. Parts of southwest England have been underwater for weeks. That's the latest news. on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, David. That's David Spencer. He'll return with the world news headlines a little later this hour, and we're going to be unpicking just some of those stories he was talking about as we continue here on Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06, 13.06 in New York City. Well, joining me now with their take on the news is Brett Mason, Europe correspondent for SBS World News Australia, and Matthew Jamieson, consultant fellow at RUSI right here in London. Gentlemen, welcome both to the programme.
Hello.
Two of my favourites on Midori House.
Thank you.
Here on this Friday evening. We're going to be starting with the situation, though, in Ukraine, where alarming news continues to break day by day. Police today opened an investigation into the kidnapping of an opposition activist who claims to have been held captive for more than a week and tortured before being left to die in the cold. He managed to survive, of course. President Viktor Yanukovych has now signed an amnesty for protesters and the repeal of harsh anti-protest laws, as long as the detained protesters leave occupied buildings that some of them are still occupying at the present. The army has been calling upon the president to take urgent action to ease the crisis. Brett and Matthew, perhaps I'll start with you. What do you think the consequences specifically of these accusations of torture are going to be? Because we've seen the troubles, we've seen protesters perishing when it's turned violent. But this looks to be something altogether even more sinister yet.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's deeply, deeply concerning. Because if you think about it, this is the most severe, serious unrest on European soil in a European country since the mayhem of the Balkan Wars and the succession of Yugoslavia in the early 90s. And we have to take what's happening in Ukraine extremely seriously. I think as though the response actually should be even tougher. Because it's appalling the unrest that's going on in there, and then these allegations of torture that have come out today, and clearly the tactics have been extremely heavy-handed.
Brett, I mean, that's an interesting comparison that Matthew draws there, or certainly sort of alluding back to, you know, the early 1990s. Do you fear, perhaps as you look back across the, you know, the last couple of decades, that we could be on the brink of something as severe as that?
And these claims are only galvanising those protesters. Remember when these protests first started, they were very peaceful. It was only when the military and the police moved in and were very violent with these protesters that we saw thousands and thousands and thousands of Ukrainians taking to the streets. And it's, what is very clear is that despite the president's offers and pretty much what he's given away, they're still there in the cold, shivering. They're not going anywhere. So it's very clear that there has to be some type of political solution to this problem. And it is a significant moment. We've seen here the Ukrainian people rising up saying, we don't want to be in bed with Russia. We want to, you know, sort of move into the European Union. And that's very, very significant. And I don't think anyone can downplay the importance of what's going on here and the fact that it's not going away despite these concessions. They're still there, they're still angry, and they still want the president to go.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about what the main actors, perhaps internationally, can do about this. But I just wondered on that point, Matthew, do you agree that these concessions as they are won't really help Yanukovych in the short term? Do you think there's anything else he can do? Will it all be dismissed merely as kind of gesture politics and empty rhetoric?
Well, I think the thing that he can do is he can step down and the government should resign immediately, and there should be a free and fair, fresh elections, which is quite clear what the overwhelming majority of the people in the country want. It's so inspirational to see the Ukrainian people out on the streets, especially at a time I feel as though when we in this country, we don't seem to really fully appreciate just how important the European Union is to the family of nations within Europe. And it's great to see people rising up and wanting to be part of the free, democratic family of nations in Europe and push back against the most appalling bullying bullying and blackmail which has been emanating from the Kremlin. And it's great to see the people in Ukraine stand up and say enough is enough, and we're not going to take our orders from Moscow and Putin. So I really feel the only thing that has to happen now is for the people's wishes to be respected and for democracy to be allowed to deliver the verdict of the people.
There is a counter-argument to that, though. It was very inspirational when I was in Tahrir Square a few years ago watching the uprising of people who were fighting against the very similar level of oppression. 3 years on, Egypt is in a lot of trouble. Some might argue it's more violent, more corrupt than ever before. So it's a very, I'm not trying to be cynical about this, I'm optimistic, but I'm just very cautious of the introduction of democracy and sweeping changes so quickly. The president going, the government going, that happened in Egypt, but what we're seeing very clearly is those people might not be in office, but they still have the power, and that's done enormous damage. Those people who went out and fought for Mubarak to go, probably sitting there, and a lot of them I know because I've been there, are sitting there going, you know what, this is actually a lot worse than what we had a few years ago. And I think that's where the international community needs to be very, very careful. If the president does go, the government also follows him, how do you handle those democratic elections? Because that's actually the hard part, not the uprising and the change. It's how you manage that. And also, in Egypt, as we saw, there were no democratic parties. There was only one candidate, and that was the Muslim Brotherhood. So how do you suddenly go from being oppressed to being a democratic organization that functions and that isn't susceptible to just someone else jumping in and sort of absorbing that power very quickly?
It's interesting, isn't it, that question of succession, because similar, I guess there are some other broad comparisons with Egypt in that there seems to be a fairly fractured opposition. No clear candidates. There's some obvious populists and people who have popular appeal. Vitaly Klitschko, for example, is often mooted, but it doesn't appear that he's perhaps going to be able to galvanise support, particularly when you consider, you mentioned, Matthew, before about the influence of the Kremlin and Putin's hands felt here. How would that succession be managed? Because one finds it rather hard to imagine that Russia would tolerate anyone who was in any way sort of even not aggressive, but even fairly reticent about dealing with Moscow, would have any chance of succeeding.
Indeed, yes. I mean, I would just hesitate slightly with some of the comparisons with Egypt, because, of course, there has been a culture and a sort of an experience and a familiarity with democracy in the Ukraine longer than there has been in Egypt. There was never any democracy in Egypt until the election that brought in Mohamed Morsi. But Ukraine has been going through the democratic process since it broke off from the Soviet Union's control in 1991. I think that really, coming back to the other point about what do you do with regards to Russia, well, quite frankly, as I think I said a few weeks ago, I feel really that it's now high time for the European Union and the United States, the international community, to take a much harder line with Russia and to really start to expect it to behave properly in accordance with international norms and rules.
Well, what does that hard line look like, though? Are we talking about sanctions? Does it have to hit these people in the pocket? Where do you draw the line?
Yeah, I mean, you can clamp down on all sorts of sort of areas, economics, trade, travel, also political and diplomatic cooperation. Because remember, at the end of the day, Russia is no longer a superpower. It is not the Soviet Union, and it is not actually, in terms of economics, economic power, and even military might, it's not in the Premier League anymore. And the European Union combined collectively is a far greater economic power than Russia, which is a sclerotic economy in decline, heavily dependent on oil and gas, and not very dynamic. So there's certainly lots of tools, soft power tools, that could be used to make the Russians back off.
Do you think there's any chance, though, of that sort of pivot to the EU from Ukraine? Because we already saw that, you know, when it was a question of almost choosing between the two, there was a leaning, certainly from the current administration, you know, back towards Moscow. Do you think we could see that change?
Well, the people were certainly very angry about that, and that's quite telling. That shows a very strong cultural shift. But it's that old saying, isn't it, the carrot or the stick? Do you try and bring people out in from the cold by killing them with kindness, or do you take a tougher stance. And you look at countries like Iran, who were effectively frozen out, and now America is desperately trying to bring them back in out of the cold and have them attend things like at Davos just recently, giving a rather extraordinary speech, trying to reach out to these people. Russia, obviously, different example, but I'm always hesitant. I mean, it's a very the natural instinct is to punish those people and teach them a lesson, but sometimes it's counterproductive. And I quite like the fact that this has happened rather organically over, as you say, since the mid-90s, there's been this leaning towards wanting to become a bigger player in Europe. And I think that's the way to make that happen. But also Russia, very, very influential. And I doubt we'll see any extreme party rise up there should there be a change of government.
Just briefly on this, Matthew, I wonder in terms of the US, we heard Barack Obama in his State of the Union address dedicate a large proportion of that to foreign policy questions. Do you think there's any appetite for, you know, on Capitol Hill to really get deeply involved with Ukraine? I mean, it's a good marker, perhaps, but is the appetite really there, or will the focus remain perhaps in the Middle East and North Africa?
That will be interesting, because I think that there should be the appetite. I don't know, really, this administration has not been terribly concerned or engaged with European affairs for understandable reasons, because, of course, the main centre of gravity is going to be Asia, and they've also got all these headaches in the Middle East. However, I feel as though they can't neglect Europe, because together, America and Europe are the most powerful alliance on the planet for freedom and democracy. And it was that alliance born out of the experience of the Second World War. And it's an alliance which has served us very well over the last 60 plus years, and it should not be neglected. So I feel as though the United States, yes, it must engage much more closely with these matters.
Now, you mentioned headaches, like in the Middle East. There's no more pounding a headache in the Middle East than Syria, of course. We've had a week-long conference in Geneva. It's ended, well, with insults from both sides of the conflicts, which is much as it started, in fact. The Syrian foreign minister, Walid Mualem, said today the opposition were immature. The opposition said the regime had no desire to stop bloodshed. What if anything, has been achieved here? I mean, what do you think, Brett? Have we wasted time, or has it been an achievement of sorts just getting these people to sit down together, however briefly?
I think that's a massive achievement, considering we're about to mark the third anniversary of the Syrian uprising, civil war, depending on which side of the fence you speak, you sit, how you would describe it. I think obviously some fairly extraordinary scenes earlier on in the talks, where we saw people shouting and screaming, and obviously, it goes without saying, there are deep divisions and anger and animosity between the two parties who are sitting down. But the fact that they've talked, we heard today there was loose agreement on 10 or so key areas, humanitarian aid able to get in now that there have been some ceasefires agreed to. How on earth either side will communicate that to the front line? Syria is an absolute mess. How the logistics of that work, I'm incredibly sceptical. I feel like I'm being very negative this afternoon, but I'm just telling it like it is.
We have to be realistic, but that's the thing.
I don't think that there's suddenly going to be this magic road on which all that aid that so many people there desperately need. My heart breaks knowing that while these talks are going on, we're seeing thousands of people die. People who are waiting for help to get there aren't getting that help. There are people in refugee camps in Jordan and Turkey and other neighbouring countries sitting there waiting for this resolution. And it's been obvious as a result of these talks that neither side is prepared to budge. The opposition want the regime to go, and the regime say that's not going to happen. And that's, you can agree 40, 50, 60, 100,000 other points, but that's the key one. And until that happens, I sadly think that there's going to be an ongoing civil war in that country, and that's devastating.
I mean, Brett's right, isn't he, Matthew, about the fundamental question perhaps there. I just wonder, going back to the actual Geneva 2 meeting, however much we welcome it, given the pressing needs on the ground, is that really the way to sort of do diplomacy with people slinging insults? Extraordinary, the fact that people were able to sort of take the floor at the beginning of these meetings and basically outline all the reasons why they're not going to be able to come to an agreement. It seemed astonishing. Do you think there were problems, though, in terms of how that actually happened?
Well, I completely agree with Brett. I would actually hazard a guess that I think that in those sort of circumstances, perhaps that was the smart thing to do, to actually allow all the parties to just vent and get out of their system. The tremendous, especially if you put yourself in the shoes of the opposition, it must have been dreadful having to sit in the same room and discuss and talk with figures from the regime that has wreaked so much destruction and murder and brutality on the people of Syria. That must have been very, very difficult. So I think it was probably actually the smart thing to do, to allow people to just, you know, get everything out of their system and then see whether they can make some progress.
And in terms, finally, on the sort of logistics of that meeting, we talked a little bit on Monocle 24 this week about this sort of rabid press pack that was there, hundreds of journalists. I mean, does that help, or should people actually see the bigger picture and leave people to get on instead of trying to secure briefings and get inside tracks? I mean, is the press perhaps culpable? I mean, Brad, I don't know what you think about that.
Thankfully, I wasn't there. Part of the
I wasn't pointing the finger, of course.
I was down the road in Davos following it very closely. But look, I think I had some concerns watching the vision that was coming out of there, because there seemed to be... And it's something that we have to be aware of when we're reporting these regions. I've been to Syria. I've reported from there. I've reported from Egypt. People are very emotional. They have a lot to say. And if you give them a platform and you give them a bit of a nudge, you can really bring those passions out. And I think that that's what we were seeing. Reporters were pushing people's buttons to get the reaction that makes that wonderful television in some people's eyes. And we were very clearly seeing that as people were going in. And I don't think that helps when you've got two sides going around a negotiating table, and on the way in, they're suddenly getting these pressure points punched, and then they're walking in to try and have calm discussions. But that being said, of course, we have a right to report these stories and talk to these people to see what's going on.
Absolutely. That's Brett Mason, Matthew Jamieson with us as well on Midori House. We're going to take a short break. When we return, French President François Hollande and his British counterpart David Cameron have been meeting today. We're discussing, amongst other things, their differing views on the potential future of the European Union. All up next on Midori House.
What is it to be typically German? Well, Rolf Sachs, a half-German, half-French artisan designer, explores the clichés that form his notion of a nation in a new exhibition at Köln's Museum of Applied Arts. Culture editor Robert Bound went to sort the Schadenfreude from the Sehnsucht.
There are certain very clear clichés, which obviously are part of the show. Punctuality, industriousness, hard-working. But I wanted to show the full depth of really German character. We always say that we are the nation of poets and thinkers. And there is always this being torn between the mind and the rationality.
Typisch Deutsch, a Robert Bound film now showing on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me in Studio One are Brett Mason and Matthew Jamieson. We're discussing some of the day's biggest news stories and a couple of the smaller ones too, just for good measure. French President François Hollande and British Prime Minister David Cameron have been meeting. Hollande flew to RAF Brize Norton Air Base, where he met the PM today. They enjoyed an agreeable pub lunch in Oxfordshire. I've seen the pictures, which is the constituency of Cameron, of course. David Cameron was hoping to persuade Hollande of the pressing need for reform of the EU. Good luck with that. Hollande responded by announcing that the EU, unsurprisingly, cannot be expected to follow the example of one individual member country. A good bit of old-fashioned political disagreement, perhaps. Matthew, what do you make of all of this? Do you think it would probably be a lot of pleasantries? I think David Cameron's probably asking François Hollande how it's all going back at home. And do you think we'll ever see a sort of a fundamental renegotiation of Britain's relationship with the EU, as some within Cameron's Tory party really want to see?
Well, I certainly hope not, because it's a complete waste of time. I think the French president was absolutely right to call the Prime Minister out on this and say, you know, this is not a top priority, to have to go back and start picking over the treaties again. Unfortunately, of course, for Mr. Cameron, most of his party, the Tory party, are absolutely bonkers when it comes to Europe. They have this pathological obsession with the European Union. They think that it is the worst thing in the world. They have compared it to the Soviet Union, some of them. They think it is a threat to democracy, and we're all being sucked into this totalitarian Brussels machine. What they don't seem to realise is that it is absolutely fundamental to Britain's position in the world, to our economic strength, to our trade, to our well-being, and also it's not 1945 anymore. And thank goodness also their lordships displayed a little touch of common sense today and kicked this silly referendum bill into the long grass, which of course is completely unconstitutional and unparliamentary, this bill, because it was attempting to bind future successive parliaments. So the Tories always go on about parliamentary sovereignty when it suits them.
Politicians being trying to just use things conveniently, I don't believe it. Brett, I just wonder, what do people in Australia make of the UK's relationship with Europe? Because it's a curious one. I think we're used to it, and Matthew's articulated, I think, very well there, exactly, the Tory slightly warped relationship. What do people make to it when you talk to them back home? Do they just think it's extraordinary, or do they somehow understand that Britain, as this sort of island nation, has this rather curious ongoing relationship?
I don't think anyone in Britain really understands how the EU works, so good luck getting someone in Sydney to explain it to you. Look, I find it, if I'm honest, quite amusing to watch this, some papers every day, it's the front page splash about how Brussels is dictating this legislation, and then you flip a few pages in another paper and Britain is outraged about this legislation. So I guess it's quite fascinating. We in Australia often complain about having three levels of government, but at least they're all in the one country and we have the one leader, so we should be thankful for that. But that being said, in a way, I guess I've come to know and love the EU over the last 4 years that I've been here, and I've learnt a lot about how it functions, and I think it's quite healthy, and having these disagreements is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, we are talking about a conservative British Prime Minister, a socialist French president, so clearly they're not going to sit down over their bangers and mash and agree on a lot of things, but the fact that they're part of this union, as you say, it's a huge, huge economic bloc, it's a political powerhouse, and being part of it offers a lot more. We can always sort of, you know, squabble over the small bits of legislation. But overall, I think when you look at it on the big picture, despite the huge amounts of money and the sittings and all those types of things, there's an enormous benefit in being part of it, even if we don't always understand what the heck's going on in Brussels.
It can be tricky to get to the bottom of it. Matthew, it's interesting, is that do you think sometimes people in the UK, perhaps on the sort of right fringes of the Conservative Party, should look, you know, at the bigger picture, maybe look even outside Europe, look to America and see what people there make of the UK relationship with Europe? Because around the world, people are generally fairly enthusiastic about the UK being part of this trading bloc, aren't they?
Absolutely. That's why I think the Conservative position on Europe is so irrational. You hear so much nonsense, errant nonsense, coming out of the Tory party and their right-wing allies in the press about the European Union. And it's so curious because, of course, the Tories are extremely pro-American and Atlanticist, but they don't seem to be able to square the circle intellectually that the United States' successive American governments, going all the way back to the Kennedy administration, have been extremely pro-EU integration and extremely pro-British participation in the EU because they see that Britain within the European Union is a strong voice for an Atlanticist, outward-looking European Union that is in alliance with the United States. So American politicians, and especially the State Department, are generally very bewildered a lot of the time by the British attitude to the EU because, of course, they understand that in the long term, it is in British national interest to be a major player within the EU. And if we're not, and we're sidelined, then our influence in the world diminishes.
Just look at the bottom line, too. There's a very simple argument, isn't it? If you're out of the EU and you lose those trading partners, suddenly you're not only competing for the rest of the world's market, you're competing for a slice of your own continent's market. And it just seems to me extraordinary that, particularly from a conservative government who is about business, is about free enterprise, is about making money if you work hard, it seems extraordinary that there's this resentment towards being part of a union that largely delivers on that.
Absolutely. Well, it hasn't stopped them yet, and I doubt it will, even if they're listening to your wise words here. I just want to finish briefly by talking about the Sochi Winter Olympics, of course, coming soon. The Russian organisers today have come up with another beautiful initiative today. They've got some special meteorite medals they're going to present to people. We remember this huge rock crashed into a lake in the Urals around a year ago. Some lucky gold medalists will receive a medal, including a piece of space rock. Do you think anyone's going to buy this kind of PR, Matthew, or do you think that some how should we put it, rather more fundamental concerns about what we're seeing in and around the Games are going to be dominating in the next, what, 2-3 weeks?
Yes, well, I mean, I think I would rather actually go to outer space than Sochi, because, quite frankly, I think it's just the most bizarre place to be holding these Olympics in the middle of an enclave of terrorist activity, very well-known terrorist activity. And not only that, I mean, such an odious regime, which is so illiberal and authoritarian and undemocratic. So I think they'll try all the PR that they like on this one, but really the outside world are going to see Putin's Russia for what it is, and it's not a very nice place.
Brett, just finally, we've seen, well, London 2012 Summer Olympics are great games. Think back to Sydney in 2000, wonderful times. We've seen all of the good it can do. Is there not a case for saying maybe this will bring a little bit of the Olympic sunshine to this slightly dark corner? Where do you stand on it?
Look, Sydney and London didn't need space junk in their medals to make it a good event. So, look, I'm negative. I'm very skeptical about Sochi. Look, I think that the Olympics is this wonderful thing. It's like the World Cup, where all these nations can get a chance to put politics aside for a week or two. But in some cases, you simply can't. When you have athletes who are being told not to wear their team kit, when you have athletes who have to disguise their relationships for fear of persecution, when you have media who are openly told, while you're here, we'll be listening to your phone calls and reading your emails, doesn't really seem to gel with the Olympic spirit, in my opinion.
I think most people would probably agree with you. That's Brett Mason and Matthew Jameson. Thank you both very much indeed for joining me here on today's Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monaco 24.
Oi, London. 这是 Monaco 24.
Ut London, tu vai Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monaco 24.
1831 here in London, plenty still to come on the second half of today's Midori House. We'll hear some of the wittiest reviews, and when I say witty, I mean excoriating, that have been shortlisted at the Hatchet Job of the Year Awards. Expect something rather like this.
No amount of straining for high-flown uplift can disguise the fact that the goldfinch is a turkey.
And we'll also check in with our woman in Brussels and review the highlights of this year's Sundance Film Festival with Stacey Wilson. Plenty to look forward to. Before we get started, though, let's hear from David Spencer, who's here with the latest world news headlines.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. The peace talks on the Syria civil war have ended in Geneva with bitter words between the two sides. The Syrian government accused the opposition groups of being immature in their discussions, while the Syrian National Coalition said the Assad regime had shown no willingness to end the bloodshed. The UN has called for an independent investigation into reports of kidnappings and torture against protesters in Ukraine. Anti-government protests have continued in Kiev, despite several concessions from President Yanukovych. The Italian man found guilty for a second time, along with Amanda Knox, of murdering a British student in Perugia, has been detained close to the border with Austria. Raphael Sollecito was stopped by police a day after a court upheld his and Knox's conviction. Italian police have found a piece of cloth stained with the blood of the late Pope John Paul II, a day after recovering a stolen gold and glass case which once contained the relic. They were stolen from an isolated mountain church last weekend. South Sudan's rebel leader Riek Machar has called for President Salva Kiir to resign. The statement comes as a tentative ceasefire continues between the warring factions in Africa's newest state. And former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg has been appointed to a senior role with the UN to help promote climate change. It comes ahead of a planned UN conference on the issue in September. Those are latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, David. David will be back with a full bulletin of world news for you at the top of the hour. Right now, though, we're ticking towards 18:34 here in London, 16:34 in Rio. It's time on Midori House to check in with one of our various far-flung correspondents around the world. Today, we're crossing over to Brussels. Our correspondent there is Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson, and she joins me now with the top stories. Charlotte, thanks for joining us on the programme, as always. We like to sometimes ponder on what are the ideal gifts for the people who have anything. But if you had 1.15 million euros and you were in Malta, you could get yourself a passport for the EU, but not anymore, I gather.
That's right, yes. If you had deep enough pockets, you are more than welcome to hand over some of your cash, well, quite a bit of your cash, depending on how much you have, and get a Maltese passport. But the problem is, the way the European Union works now, you have a Maltese passport, you can live and work in any country in the EU. So this caused absolute outrage amongst politicians in other countries. And there was a massive debate in the European Parliament a couple of weeks ago where one MEP after another stood up and said, this isn't what being European is about. It's about living in a country, committing to a country, not about how deep your pockets are. So yes, in the last couple of days, Malta has finally had to cave in. And now they say you do have to actually live there for a year. And then hand over your cash, and then you can be Maltese.
And what do you think, Charlotte? Is that going to keep everyone happy?
Well, at the moment, it seems to be keeping the European Union happy. It was the European Commission making moves at taking potential legal infringement proceedings against Malta that really, I think, got them to change their mind. The people who might not be happy are the Chinese, Saudi, Russian billionaires and millionaires who hoped it would be a little bit easier. So they're the ones losing out, I think.
Charlotte, now, if you were going to, with your freshly minted passport, fly from Malta to elsewhere in the EU, you'd be getting on a plane, obviously. And I gather that that might be an altogether less stressful enterprise, depending on something else that we've learned today.
Yes, absolutely. So from today, the restrictions on liquids in your hand luggage in the EU are going to be, I'm not going to say lifted, because it's going to be a little bit anticlimactic, but slightly amended. This is one of the first of many steps which the European Union hopes by 2016 means that we can, you know, take our sun lotion, our bottles of water and our hand luggage. But today the change just means that you can bring in duty-free from outside the EU, and as long as it's properly packaged and you have the receipt, you can transit it in an EU airport. So as you can see, it's not exactly revolutionary, but it's the first step towards, I think, what we'll all be glad to see the back of.
Absolutely. I always feel like nobody does a slight amendment quite like the EU, do they? You must be in the city of slight amendments in Brussels, Charlotte. Let's talk a little bit more about, sort of EU politics, parliamentary elections, this kind of thing. The EU's been trying, hasn't it, very hard to really spice up the European parliamentary elections. And I can only assume that all across Europe, people are excited everywhere. Is that right?
Oh, yes. I mean, absolutely. I think that, you know, you ask anyone in the streets of London, they're going, no, we support Michel Barnier for the European Commission president. And in pubs, someone else is slamming down a pint going, no, it's Jean-Claude Juncker for me. I'm sure that discussion is going on everywhere. Well, in the European Commission's hopes it is, because that was the whole point of this new system that they introduced in the Lisbon Treaty, which is this is the first elections where you're going to have figureheads, you're going to have leaders like you do in any other election, leading these political blocs from the European Parliament into these elections. And the idea was, exactly as you said, was to replicate some of the excitement and the personalities which come from these elections. You look at the US elections, I mean, how much coverage you get about Hillary Clinton already, it's just endless. But, I mean, like I said, the problem is people just don't know who these people are. You know, do they really sit around talking about the European Union's Internal Markets Commissioner? Not so sure.
Well, it's fairly early on a Friday night here in London, and I'm just getting warmed up for exactly that kind of conversation, believe you me. I just wonder, if this doesn't work then, Charlotte, what do you think they should do? I mean, do they need to change the formats? Is it about putting a more popular kind of front on the whole enterprise? You know, taking cues from some of those shiny floor format TV shows or something? How can they possibly actually spice this up enough to engage with people throughout the EU?
Well, that's a really good question, because the only parties that actually seem to be able to engage people and get headlines are the anti-EU establishment, or the really far-right parties, or the far-left parties, anti-immigration parties. I mean, you think about how many headlines the UK Independence Party gets there, and there in Britain. And so it's having these completely out there policies that seem to be able to galvanise voters. But if you look at what the Green Party just did this week, they thought they could really enthuse the electorate by opening up their primary to every single European over the age of 16. So that's 400 million people could vote for who they wanted to be the Green Party's candidate in these elections. But of those 400 million Europeans, only 22,000 logged on and voted, which isn't really a huge proportion. That doesn't signal a huge amount of interest.
It certainly does not. That's Monocle's Brussels correspondent, Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson. Charlotte promised me there's no more talking about European parliamentary elections on this Friday night in Brussels, I hope.
I'll try and restrain myself. I'll do my best.
Good stuff. That's Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson. Up next on Midori House, we'll hear some of the wittiest, cleverest and funniest reviews which have been shortlisted in the Hatchet Job of the Year Award. Stay tuned for more here on Monocle 24.
The menu isn't just about food or drinks, it's about the people with innovative ideas, the ones who savor traditions, and the ones who are willing to go further than most in search of the most delicious ingredients. Whether it's an author who's discovered true adventure through food, or a master bartender traveling the world in search of new and exciting flavors, the menu uncovers the tastiest tales from around the globe.
We are finally walking to the simple way of eating, being, but I think it's a universal trend, this kind of simplicity.
As well as going behind the scenes with top chefs such as René Redzepi and Massimo Bottura, we find out the latest in restaurant design, the creative culinary experiences keeping city dwellers' taste buds tingling, and what Japanese clubbing culture and noodles have in common. Join me, Markus Hipp, before the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day, there's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got The Curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator, here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. It's 1841 here in London. It's that time of year again. The Hatchet Job of the Year Award, which is awarded to the angriest, funniest, most trenchant book review. Now in its third year, the actual ceremony takes place a little later in February. But the shortlist is out and we're going to discuss some of the finest reviews from the last 12 months. Now, the award's been set up by online magazine Omnivore. And I'm delighted to say I'm joined in the studio now by its editor, Fleur MacDonald. Fleur, hello, welcome to the programme. Great to have you with us. There's something undeniably appealing, isn't there, about a classic hatchet job. Why is it almost more satisfying to read a hatchet job than even a glowing review? What is it about it? Are we just all really evil people at heart?
I think so, probably. Probably. We're probably all very nasty. I think it helps that most of them are funnier than glowing reviews. And if it's truly a good hatchet job, it's got a point. So it's really telling you what nobody else has dared to say.
And can you still presumably be recognised on your shortlist, even if it's a book that actually draws pretty widespread praise? You're still happy, if there's a dissenting voice, to laud it. Does that actually help? Is that even better, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, rather, we kind of grandiosely call it tipping sacred cows. So we're really after the big guns of the literary world, and to show everybody that you don't necessarily need to like the Booker Prize winner or the latest winner of the National Book Awards. Our judges, they're quite important people. And it's Brian Sewell, who is the art critic for the Evening Standard, Rosie Boycott, who was the first female editor of two national newspapers and also founded Spare Rib, and John Sutherland, who is professor at UCL and also writes for The Guardian, The Independent, and lots of other places. it's them that kind of selected the shortlist and decided these were the people, that these were the reviewers that really had a point when it came to criticizing people that were authors that others dare not criticize.
And those people know their stuff. We've actually got a couple of little extracts which we can voice. Let's hear from one. So The Luminaries by Ellen Canton. Let's hear this one. This was from David Sexton's review. Let's take a listen.
Let's concede that The Luminaries is a stunning feat of construction. The Booker judges knew, whatever else its merits, they were giving the prize to a tremendously technically accomplished piece of work. I suspect some exhausted reviewers praised it for the same reason. It doesn't necessarily make it any good, of course. A ship made of matchsticks in a bottle is a feat of construction, but not necessarily a great work of art.
Oh, David Sexton, that's a kind of like, what's that, damning with faint praise, perhaps. Does that one deliver, you think, in terms of all of the main things that we need for a good old-fashioned hatchet job?
It definitely does. Have you tried reading the book? Have you looked at The Luminaries?
I was too scared off by what David Sexton wrote, to be honest.
Right, that's a good excuse. It's 800 pages long, and it won the Booker Prize. So I think that people feel daunted when it comes to reading it. And I have to be honest, I tried. And I was so relieved when someone else said exactly what I was thinking. And I'm only 40% through on my Kindle. Because David Sexton said it was okay for me to stop, I think I'm going to.
That's where we'll call it. We'll draw a line there. Okay, what about, if there was ever a book that divided opinion in the last year, it's probably Morrissey's autobiography, for various reasons, which perhaps we'll talk about. A.A. Gill, a man who doesn't always hold his tongue. Let's hear what he made of it.
There are many pop autobiographies that shouldn't be written, some to protect the unwary reader and some to protect the author. In Morris's case, he's managed both. This is a book that cries out like one of his maudlin ditties to be edited. But were an editor to start, there would be no stopping. It's a heavy tome, utterly devoid of insight, warmth, wisdom, or likability. It's a potential firelighter of vanity, self-pity, and logorrheic dullness. Putting it in Penguin Classics doesn't diminish Aristotle or Homer or Tolstoy. It just roundly mocks Morrissey. And this is a humiliation constructed by the self-regard of its victim.
Well, if ever there was an excoriating review, that's it. And of course, that's alluding to the fact that Morrissey sort of insisted that this book came out in Penguin Classics. What did you make of that whole round? Do you think it kind of invited exactly that sort of reaction?
Of course it did. And I think that's a hatchet job that's interesting, because not only is it a hatchet job on the author, it's a hatchet job on the editors and the publishing industry as a whole. And I think that sometimes editors think that they can make an easy buck and they can basically get someone famous to write anything they want and they'll just sell. And A.A. Gill really told them, well, he told them off, basically.
And in his unique style, of course, as well. We have a final one. Let's hear this one. This is about Donna Tartt's book, The Goldfinch. Peter Kemp's verdict. Let's hear this one.
Outdoing even The Little Friend, famously a decade in the writing, The Goldfinch has taken 11 years to appear. These epic gestations are attributed by awed Tartt admirers and devotees of websites such as Donna Tartt Shrine to uncompromising perfectionism. It's because of perfectionism that man walked on the moon and painted the Sistine Chapel, okay? Perfectionism is good, she has stressed. It is hard to spot much of it in this ineptly put together book. No amount of straining for high-flown uplift can disguise the fact that The Goldfinch is a turkey.
Oh, a turkey. Peter Kemp's damning indictment of The Goldfinch. Again, quite a lot of elan to that one. Does that one meet your approval levels as well?
It certainly does. I think it really takes apart the author's pretensions. And it does so with style and with humour, something that, you know, sometimes Donna Tartt can be somewhat lacking in. I think that The Goldfinch, it was praised before even anyone had even read it. So it's nice to see someone saying, it's not worth the bother.
Absolutely. I just wondered, though, in terms of that idea of authors and I guess publishing houses, to a certain extent, encouraging that pursuit of perfection. Is there a risk, you think, that if we do sort of roundly deride that notion that, you know, ultimately the art that we all enjoy might suffer? Or do you think it's good to just sort of prick the pomposity every now and again?
I don't think you can take any of these reviews or the prize itself too seriously. After all, you do win a year's supply of potted shrimp if you're the lucky reviewer. And that's actually, I've got to say that's not a joke. The omnivore, after a lot of serious research, was discovered to be our favourite omnivore, because the shrimp is a little known fact that the shrimp is an omnivore. So we decided that it was a worthy prize. So there's a lot, it's not serious. It's just about having fun with reviewing literature books.
Absolutely. Well, I think it certainly delivers on that front. Remind us, we'll find out the winner on...
the 11th of February.
Oh, stay tuned, people. That's when we'll find out who gets the treasured prize. That's Fleur MacDonald, editor of Omnivore. Thank you very much, Fleur, for joining us here on Midori House. We're going to have a bit of music now. We've been talking about nasty reviews and clever ones, but let's err on the side of the nasty. This is Janet Jackson. This is Nasty.
No, my first name ain't baby. It's Janet. Miss Jackson, if you're nasty. Nasty boys.
In the spirit of hatchet job reviews, that was Nasty from Janet Jackson. You're with Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 8 minutes before the top of the hour. We're approaching the end of the programme, but as promised before, we are going to have our daily review segment. Today we're talking about movies because it's Friday. The Sundance Film Festival concluded in Park City, Utah a few days ago, and we're going to review the festival and talk about the highlights from there. And I'm delighted to say I'm joined on the line now from Los Angeles by Stacey Wilson, Senior Editor of The Hollywood Reporter. Stacey, hello. Thanks very much for joining us on the programme. Tell me, what will be the sort of abiding memory of this year's Sundance Festival? Anything there that really stood out, do you think, as making its mark?
Well, I think it was an interesting festival because there wasn't one clear, universally loved film like we saw a couple of years ago with Beasts of the Southern Wild, which of course went on to be an Oscar nominee. But this year we did see a number of films that were very well liked and a few standout performances. There were three favorites that I'll share with you now if you'd like. There was a wonderful film called Whiplash, which tells the story of a music student, a drumming student specifically played by Miles Teller, who made a big splash last year in the film Spectacular Now. And it's a sort of a contentious relationship between him and his drumming teacher, played by J.K. Simmons, a wonderful actor. And that film actually won the Grand Jury and Audience Awards last weekend at the festival. And what's interesting about that film is that the director, Damien Chazelle, was actually at the festival last year with a short version of that film. So the fact that he was able to parlay his short within a year, turn it into a feature, submit it in time for the festival, and then it ended up winning the audience prize was definitely the movie that everyone was talking about. It opened the festival on that first Thursday and had a huge reception. Sometimes the opening night festival films don't receive great receptions, which is why they're the first ones, because a lot of people aren't in town yet. So it was fun to see that film get the response that we had hoped, because we all loved it. So that was kind of the first great one.
Absolutely. What do you think Damien Chazelle's, what does the future hold for him then? Because that's an impressive achievement. As you said, he's also got some great performances from, you know, veteran actors like J.K. Simmons in that. Do you think the future very bright then for Damien Chazelle?
I think, you know, the film did get distribution. It was picked up by Sony Classics, which is interesting because Sony Classics, for us in the U.S., we know that mostly as the company that distributes and releases all of Woody Allen's films. So this is kind of a younger skewing film for them to pick up at the festival, which is great, which means that it'll make it to theaters. Audiences will see it, unlike a lot of these films, which I always feel so terrible for these filmmakers. They spend years of their lives on these projects, and then some of them just sort of fade away into obscurity. So I think Damien has a huge, huge future, purely because his first big feature was picked up at the festival. That's an amazing achievement.
Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about life itself, Stacey. Before I get your view on it, let's hear a little bit from the movie itself. Here it is.
We all are born with a certain package. We are who we are. Where we were born, who we were born as, how we were raised. We're kind of stuck inside that person. And the purpose of civilization and growth is to be able to reach out and empathize a little bit with other people. And for me, the movies are like a machine that generates empathy. It lets you understand a little bit more about different hopes, aspirations, dreams, and fears. It helps us to identify with the people who are sharing this journey with us.
Yeah, some from the movie Life Itself. Sounds emotional. Stacey, what did you make of it?
Well, of course, that's the voice of our beloved late film critic, Roger Ebert, whose life is documented in the documentary. And what's very sweet about this film, aside from it being just sort of gut-wrenching, watching the final horrifying years of his life with his health struggles with cancer, the director of the film is Steve James, who, of course, film buffs will know. 20 years ago, Steve came to Sundance with his amazing documentary about basketball players called Hoop Dreams. And that was a film that Roger Ebert was a huge champion of. There's a wonderful photo I recently saw of him at the festival 20 years ago cheering on Steve James. And now 20 years later, Steve, who became a good friend of Roger's, you know, was chosen to document the final years of his life. And actually, Roger's widow, Chaz Ebert, a wonderful lady who I actually met at the festival, she was present at the premiere, and she had never seen the film until that night. So it was just a real tearjerker moment. Just anyone who loves movies loved Roger Ebert. He was an underdog. He was a champion of underdog filmmakers, and that was a very, very moving night for sure for a lot of people. And I think everyone was relieved that the film was so good, because a film about a film critic, you want to be excellent, and it was.
Absolutely. Well, it sounds like it did justice to his memory. Stacey, just very briefly, time to mention one other picture. Briefly, tell us a little bit about Boyhood.
Well, Boyhood is a wonderful experiment turned into a wonderful film. A Richard Linklater, of course, an indie Sundance stalwart who made his film debut with Slacker in 1991. So we've gotten very used to seeing him at the festival. He's actually an Oscar nominee for this year for Before Midnight, the film that third film in the series he did with Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke. Boyhood is a film that was filmed over the course of 12 years. If you can imagine the logistics of pulling that off. He filmed for 2 weeks every year for 12 years, and it essentially chronicles the life of a young man and his divorced parents, played by Patricia Arquette and Ethan Hawke. And I think it sort of made an impact almost in the same way Tree of Life had a couple years ago, which wasn't at the festival, but very existential, very moving. No one walked out of that theater unaffected, and I think it was a wonderful, and Ethan Hawke told me, he said, you know, I'm surprised no one had attempted this in the past, and I think it's because very few people could have kind of hung in there this long. It's very hard to make a movie over the course of 12 years, to say the least. So those three films, I think, will be kind of left a mark on Sundance this year, and hopefully they'll all find mass audiences, which is really the goal of the whole thing.
Absolutely. I hope they do too. Stacey Wilson, Senior Editor of The Hollywood Reporter, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House today. That's all we have time for on today's programme. My thanks in particular to my special guests, Matthew Jameson and Brett Mason. Today's show was produced by Marco Sippi, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maddie Arouge, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Up next, it is time for The Menu with Marco Sippi, Madrid Fusion on the menu this week. Stay tuned for that one. 2200, don't forget to stay tuned for the Monocle Daily with Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson. This show's back at the same time on Monday. That's 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, from me, Tom Edwards, and all the team, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
It tells the story of a passion for motor racing, a legend forged over time by the pioneers of speed and great drivers. The Daytona Cosmograph, the watch made to break barriers, the watch dedicated to endurance, the watch that was born to race. Rolex.